Hello. I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Ian Horrocks from the Oxford Computing Laboratory to give the first Wednesday seminar of the term. Professor Horrocks has moved to Oxford from Manchester a couple of years ago. His research on description logics has been incredibly influential in the development of the semantic web technology, and his topic today is scalable ontology-based information systems, so he'll be talking about that sort of research. Thanks very much.
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me, and thank you for the nice introduction. So yes, I'm going to say something today about scalable ontology-based information systems, or at least we have the goal of making them scalable. So I suppose I should start out by at least trying to answer the inevitable question, what is an ontology? So you'll see lots of different definitions of what constitutes an ontology, but I would say in computer science terms and in most applications, an ontology really consists of a model of some aspect of the world. And basically what this model does is it introduces some vocabulary that's relevant to that domain. And there are applications across lots of different domains, but you'll see many ontologies in medicine describing things like anatomy, introducing the relevant vocabulary there, biology, bioinformatics, so there might be vocabulary related to research into viruses. Aerospace is another area. Dogs, if you're interested in the anatomy of dogs. Hot dogs, perhaps. So we might want to introduce some relevant vocabulary for describing hot dogs. So whatever you like, you'd like to have this vocabulary that you can use for talking about this domain. And another crucial point is that ontologies specify the meaning of the terms that are the meaning of these vocabulary terms. So in our anatomy ontology, it might say something like the heart is a muscular organ that's part of the circulatory system. And finally, at least from a computer science perspective, it's very useful if the ontology is formalized using some suitable logic, because then we can provide computational services. It's well defined what these kinds of things that we write down. We can provide a formal definition of these kinds of more informal statement. So this statement we might write down in first order logic like this. We might say for all x, if x is a heart, then x is a muscular organ and there exists some y such that y is a part of x and y is the circulatory system. So this is just a first order logic formalization of this kind of informal statement. So the most widely used ontology language today is an ontology language called OWL, which stands slightly counterintuitively for the web ontology language, but this was justified by the fact that apparently OWL in the Christopher Robin stories used to spell his name Wall. So we thought if it was good enough for OWL, it was good enough for the web ontology language. OWL is a W3C recommendation, which is what they call a kind of a standard, and its development was motivated by the semantic web activity. I'm not going to say much about the semantic web today, but broadly speaking, the idea there was to add meaning to web content by annotating it. Instead of just annotating it as in HTML to describe the way you display it, to annotate it with some terms from a formal vocabulary that would help to capture the meaning of the content. So in a way, one of the most important things that came out of that was because of the development of the standard, this provided the impetus for the development of a huge range of tools and infrastructure to support developing and using ontologies. So, you know, you can go out there on the web now and you can find APIs and development ontology development environments, reasoners, and so on. that you can use to develop applications. And this has resulted, well, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing. I'm not quite sure whether that was because there were a lot of applications of OWL, or there were a lot of applications of OWL because there were tools and infrastructure. But in any case, it's now very widely used broadly within the web and outside, and is supported by all of this stuff. And finally, I mentioned on the first slide that one of the points about ontologies is that we should formalize them. They're formalized using some suitable logic. And this ontology language is based on a description logic. In fact, it's based on this specific description logic. Description logics all have these strange names, but basically these are just acronyms for the different constructors that the language supports. So I'm just going to briefly say something about description logics, but I'm not going to go into any real detail on that because I want to talk more about this kind of scalability aspect, and I'll just chew up the whole time if I start telling you all about description logics. So what is there to know about description logics? The crucial thing to know is that they're fragments of first-order logic that are designed for knowledge representation, so the kind of the constructors that are provided are the kinds of thing that have proved to be useful when doing KR. And these fragments are chosen in order to also have desirable computational properties, because we want to be able to provide these tools and services to applications. So in particular, they're decidable fragments. This is generally considered to be an essential feature. And if possible, we'd like them to be of low computational complexity so we can provide effective tools. That's desirable. Unfortunately, for more expressive languages, it's generally the case that the complexity is quite high. And the other thing that you could say about them is that they have a sort of slightly more succinct and quantifier-free syntax. So if I wanted to write down this same definition of a heart in description logic, I can sort of lose the explicit quantifiers and variables, and I end up with this expression in a description logic, which you can see says more or less, says exactly the same thing, in fact, that the heart is a muscular organ that's part of the circulatory system. Description logic knowledge bases consist of two parts, actually. They have this part that defines the vocabulary, which we can think of as the ontology, and this is usually called a T-box in description logic, which means the terminology box. It's introducing this terminology or vocabulary, and in there you have all of these kinds of definitions of the vocabulary. So we defined heart already, and we might say something like heart disease is a disease that affects the heart. This is an if and only if, as opposed to an implication. So we're saying this is an exact definition. So if you're a disease that affects the heart, then you're a heart disease, and vice versa. And similarly, we might say that vascular disease is a disease that affects part of the circulatory system. So this is the kind of thing that we can write down in a description logic. And then there's a second part, which are some ground facts that are describing some particular instantiation of the terminology. And this is usually called the A box in a description logic, for an assertion box. So we make some assertions about a concrete situation. We might say things like, John is a patient who suffers from heart disease. So now that we know, hopefully, roughly speaking, what ontologies are, the next question that might naturally occur to us is, what are ontologies good for? So, well, one thing they're good for is for establishing some coherent and user-centric view of the domain. So in many applications now, you'll find that in many areas now, people are developing these large vocabularies that they use for data exchange and so on. And actually, constructing these hierarchical vocabularies, they can be very large. One of the ones that they use in medicine, for example, the one that they use in the National Health Service contains about 450,000 different vocabulary terms. And building and maintaining that is hugely expensive and difficult process. and providing some formalization and some tools that can help support that is very useful. And it also helps to identify and resolve disagreements. So often people think they're agreeing just because they're using the same vocabulary terms, but actually they may have different understandings of what the meanings of those terms are. And this has certainly come out in the medical domain. You'll very often hear things like, surprisingly, in France they have a much lower incidence of liver disease. You know, you'd think drinking all that wine, they'd have terrible problems. But actually, when you push into it, it may turn out that they just have a different definition of what constitutes liver disease. And many of these kinds of things came out when the international efforts to formalize medical vocabularies have been carried out. So that's one useful aspect. Another useful aspect is to use ontologies in ontology-based information systems, where the idea is to provide a sort of enriched kind of database system. So you use the ontology to provide a view over the data that's independent of the logical or physical schema. So the ontology in this setting is rather like the schema in the conceptual schema in a database. It allows users to pose queries in terms that are familiar to them, so they can use this vocabulary from the ontology in order to formulate queries without having to know anything about the implementational details of the information system. You can build an information system where the answer reflects both knowledge and data. So, for example, if we were to ask a query such as patients suffering from vascular disease, if I flip back to my previous example here, so, is John in the answer to this query? So in a sort of standard database system, he probably wouldn't be, because we asked for patients suffering from vascular disease and we know that John suffers from heart disease. But if we incorporate the knowledge from the ontology when we're computing the answer, then we can easily see that heart disease is a kind of vascular disease, because the heart is part of the circulatory system, and so then John should be in the answer. So we can provide this much richer query answering mechanism. We can provide things like query navigation and refinement, so it might be easier for users to find the information they're looking for by sort of navigating through this vocabulary, this hierarchical vocabulary. And the system can do things like suggest to the user either specializations or generalizations of their query in case the answer to the query is too large or too small. So maybe if I ask this query, I would get far too many answers. And if I have an ontology behind there, the ontology might say, well, do you really want to see all the answers to this query? There are however many of them. Perhaps we could suggest you might like to ask for patients with heart disease, which is a slightly more specialized but related query. And we can deal more effectively with incomplete and semi-structured data. So databases are notoriously not very good at this. They only have this rather blunt instrument of the null, whereas when we have an ontology behind there, we can we could say things like, every person has a mother. But in the database, we may not have the data. Who is the mother of every person? In fact, inevitably, we won't have, because then we'd have an infinite amount of data, because every new mother we introduce themselves has to have a mother. In the ontology, we can express this fact, everybody has a mother, and then people who we don't have the data for, they can still be in the answer to this query for person that has a mother, even though we don't know who that mother is. And we can deal better with semi-structured data. And finally, ontologies are very useful for integrating information from multiple databases or multiple sources, not all of which are necessarily relational structures. So we can use this one global vocabulary and then map the query to multiple information sources. So all this sounds absolutely great. You know, I'm sure you'll have no trouble purely from the point of view of the capabilities provided in selling this to your customer. They want an information system. Of course they want all this stuff. So what's the problem? Well, you know, the next question that anybody who knows anything about database systems will ask you is, oh yes, all this sounds great, but what about scalability? I'm sure it only really works on these toy examples where you have a few of the, you know, small number of axioms. And indeed, you know, scalability is a problem. These systems are only useful in practice if we can deal with very large ontologies and or very large data sets. And unfortunately, it is the case that many ontology languages are highly intractable. So the OWL, actually OWL is in its in a sort of second incarnation now called OWL2, and satisfiability for OWL2 ontologies is doubly non-deterministic exponential in respect of the size of the ontology. So that's pretty bad in the worst case. So how do we address this problem in practice? Can we really deliver these miracle information systems to people and actually have them work? Well, we try to do that, and we try to address this scalability problem via several different means. One of them is to develop algorithms that work well in typical cases. So, of course, we know from the complexity class that there can always be pathological cases that won't work well. We also build very highly optimized implementations that try to exploit the characteristics of these typical cases. And another thing we can do is look for and try to use tractable fragments, so subsets of the language that work in given application areas but that have better computational properties. And I'm going to try and say just a little bit about these various different approaches whilst keeping an eye on the time. So the standard reasoning technique that's used with the full language, next-time-complete language, is tableau reasoning. I'll just give you a very brief overview of how tableau reasoning works. So what tableau reasoning does is it basically reduces more or less any reasoning task you may have, any query you want to ask, it reduces it to a satisfiability problem. So, for example, if we wanted to ask the question, does our knowledge base entail that heart disease is a subclass of vascular disease, which I think we'll all agree the little example ontology that I showed you before does entail that, The way we check that using our automated reasoning system is, our tableau algorithm is, that we take the knowledge base, we add to it an assertion about a new individual, X, and we say this individual is an instance of heart disease and not vascular disease. So if I can find a model in which such an individual exists, then that's a counterexample to my hypothesis that the knowledge base entails this subsumption relation. If I find that this is unsatisfiable, no such individual can exist, then this entailment relation holds. And the way tableau algorithms work is they just try constructively to build an abstraction of such a model. So they start out with this individual that's an instance of heart disease and vascular disease. Well, obviously, it also has to be an instance of heart disease. You know, it's simply just decomposing this conjunction. And from the ontology, I know that heart disease is a disease that affects the heart. So X is an instance of both of those things as well. Now, because of this existential, I know there must exist some new individual Y that's in this effects relationship with X, where Y is a heart, and heart's a muscular organ that's part of the circulatory system, and so there's a new Z that's circulatory system. So I just go on like this, decomposing the vocabulary, using the ontology, and constructing a model. But the other thing I know about X is that it's not a vascular disease, so I have to carry on constructing the model for being not a vascular disease. So that means that it's either not a disease or it doesn't affect the circulatory system. And now I've got some non-determinism here. I have to make a choice. So I'll say, okay, let's assume X is not a disease. So I add that information. But now it's easy to see that I've derived the fact that X is both a disease and not a disease. So that's not a model. I'm not succeeding in building a model here. So I backtrack and I try the other choice here. I say that X affects the circulatory system. I carry on with my construction. Oh, I have to do a little bit of logical maneuvering here to push the negation inside. So as I'm sure you all know, you can push this negation inside and flip the existentials to being a universal. So this just says that everything it affects is not part of the circulatory system. So X is related to Y via this effect, so Y now must be part of not circulatory system, and Y is connected to Z by is part of, so Z must not be a circulatory system, and now we're back to a contradiction. I've got that Z is a circulatory system and Z is not a circulatory system. So I tried all the options I have now. I only made this one non-deterministic choice. I went both ways. Both ways led to a contradiction. So I didn't succeed in finding a model, and so I conclude that it's not satisfiable and this entailment does in fact hold. Of course, there are quite a lot of details here that I didn't tell you about. We have to be careful to make sure we really terminate and we don't go on constructing this model forever, and we have to make sure that we construct the model in such a way that if a model exists, then I really will find one. Otherwise, simply failing to find a model like this may not be enough to prove that the entailment holds. It's easy to see that if I do find a model, it's pretty easy to show that obviously as a model, but to prove that not finding a model means that there isn't a model is a bit more tricky. So that's roughly how they work. And in practice, highly optimized implementations of these algorithms are used that employ all sorts of tricks to try to make them work well in typical cases. So they only kind of expand the information from the ontology on a sort of on-demand basis, which is typically called lazy unfolding. They do some simplification and rewriting to start with. So, they'll take an axiom like this that's kind of complex to deal with in this form, and they transform it into a simpler to deal with form that they can apply lazy unfolding to. There's a new kind of take on these algorithms, actually, that Boris Motyk and Rob Shearer developed, that use techniques from hyper-resolution to try to minimize the amount of non-determinism, because even with this rewriting, now we've got a disjunction on the right-hand side. And actually, this is really a Horn clause, so we ought to be able to reason with it deterministically. And in hyper-tableau algorithms, they can deal with these clauses directly and avoid introducing this non-determinism. Fast semi-decision procedures are employed, so you initially try some easy way to prove satisfiability or unsatisfiability, but if they fail, then you may have to fall back to the full algorithm. Various search optimizations, dependency-directed backtracking, and so on, caching and reuse of computations, heuristics that guide the order in which you make these non-deterministic choices, tons of other stuff. Actually, none of these algorithms is computationally optimal, so the algorithm itself has an even higher complexity than this to next time, but they've proved to be effective with many realistic ontologies. However, there are still scalability issues, so we still find ontologies out there for which these algorithms don't work terribly well. And in particular, cyclical ontologies tend to be a problem. Very large ontologies and cyclical ontologies. So if we look in a bit more detail about the sort of thing we might find in our anatomy ontology, we might find a model of the heart that says something like the left side of the heart has a component that's the aortic valve, and the aortic valve is connected to the left ventricle, and the left ventricle is a division of the left side, which takes us back in at the beginning here. And you can immediately see that in principle I might have a termination problem here if I was using one of these constructive algorithms. And the algorithm can deal with that. They have what they call blocking strategies, which recognize when you're doing a kind of infinite but repetitive construction. But when you have large numbers of these kinds of cyclical axiom, you can end up building a very, very large model before everything settles down into a regular repetitive structure that you can spot with these kind of blocking strategies and halt the construction and declare victory. You succeeded in finding a model. And these kinds of ontology tend to be problematical for these model construction algorithms. Also, as I mentioned before, some ontologies are very, very large. They define tens or even hundreds of thousands of terms. And the way the model construction algorithms work, they perform some reasoning task. Typically, what you want to do with these hierarchical ontologies is compute the class hierarchy. So you want to build this, it's usually tree-like structure, you know, that starts with thing at the top and then it has organ down here somewhere and heart underneath organ and so on. You want to construct this, which is called classification. And to do that when you've got hundreds of thousands of different terms involves a huge number of individual operations when you're using a reasoning system that is only able to compare two distinct elements to see whether they're in a subsumption relationship or not. So another problem that arises, a sort of slightly different problem, is the problem where we have very large data sets. So in the second kind of application I was talking about, where we're using an ontology as part of an information system and we're trying to use this ontology as a view over the data and to enrich queries and so on, then we may have to deal with data as well as with the ontology. And in this case, the main reasoning problem is typically query answering rather than this classification problem. So what we want to be able to do is answer these standard kind of conjunctive queries, which are really just the kind of thing that you would ask of a database. So this says, give me all of the patients who suffer from vascular disease, and you know, patient X suffers from X, Y, and vascular disease Y. This is actually a quite distinct reasoning problem, and in fact the decidability of this problem is still open for OWL. We don't even know whether or not it's possible to find an algorithm that can guarantee to answer such queries, although relatively minor restrictions restore decidability. The problem arises when you allow these non-distinguished variables, like the y in this case is what we call a non-distinguished variable because it doesn't occur in the answer. If you allow the query to have cycles amongst these non-distinguished existential variables, then things can get quite hairy, and it's not clear yet whether that's even decidable for OWL. When if you're using these standard tableau type of techniques, the problem here is that, well, even with these restrictions, the way we know to how to answer such queries is to reduce them to our standard reasoning, our standard entailment satisfiability reasoning task. But this basically means iterating over all candidate answers. So if the query has just a single individual in the answer, basically this means iterating over all of the individuals we know and asking the question, does the knowledge base entail that that individual is in the answer to the query? So obviously, that's not going to be too good if there are millions of individuals and you have to perform millions of these reasoning operations. Moreover, for more expressive logics at least, when you're doing each reasoning task, you actually have to start the model construction with all of the ground facts. So you start with this kind of core ground part, which defines arbitrary relations between individuals, and then you try to see if you can expand that to make a model that is consistent with all the axioms in the ontology. And of course, if you have a huge amount of data, then this initial thing you start from is very large, and so that can be costly. And of course, the in the nature of data sets, there's no sort of natural limit on the size of them. You could argue that when you're building a conceptual model, it's probably never going to get bigger than, you know, a certain amount. But with data, well, apparently it seems it can just go on growing and growing and growing. I know that I keep filling up the hard disk on my laptop, so, you know, apparently there's no limit to how much data that we can produce. So the solution, or a sort of way to address this problem in OWL2, is what are called profiles, which is a fancy term for decidable fragments of the language that have a better computational complexity. So OWL2 defines several of these profiles, two of which are of particular interest. One of them is called OWL2EL, and this is targeted at the first kind of problem that I described, which is the one where the ontology is very large, contains a huge vocabulary. And then there's another fragment called OWL2QL, which is targeted at these kinds of application where there are very large data sets. So I'll just tell you a little bit about these fragments and the kinds of reasoning procedure that we can use there. So OWL2EL is a near-maximal fragment of OWL2, such that satisfiability checking is polynomial. In fact, it's p-time complete. It turns out that the data complexity of query answering is also p-time complete. So I don't know how familiar you are with these complexity terms, but when I talk about satisfiability, I'm talking about the complexity with respect to the size of the ontology. But often when you're more interested in query answering, what you're really interested in is how the complexity grows with the size of the data. So you assume the ontology is a fixed size, and you want to know, if I add more and more data, how will the complexity grow then? And we call this data complexity. In this case, data complexity is also p-time complete. So this fragment is based on the EL family of description logics. And because of the fact that we're in this polynomial time complexity class, we can exploit a new kind of reasoning procedure, which are called saturation-based reasoning techniques. And what they do is they compute the whole classification in a single pass. So they take the ontology and basically they saturate it with all induced subsumption relationships. These are, unlike the Tableau algorithms, these algorithms are computationally optimal for this fragment. And actually, in a very nice piece of recent work from Yevgeny Kazakov, he's shown how this technique can be extended to the Horn fragment of OWL2EL, which is outside of the polynomial time class, but it gives you significantly more expressive power. So roughly, how do these techniques work? Well, what happens here is you normalize the ontology into some standard form of axioms. So you're only allowed to have axioms of this form, but you can easily take an arbitrary axioms and normalize them into this form. And then you use a saturation process, so you basically apply some inference rules to the set of axioms that you have to generate new axioms, and you just keep going until you can't apply the rules anymore, and then the theory is saturated, and A subsumes C just in case you end up with the axiom A is a subclass of C in this saturated ontology. And if you do this extension to the Horn fragment that I was just mentioning, then basically what you need are very many more and more complicated rules. But just sticking with the simple form, just an example of how that works. So if we start out with some simple ontology that says organ transplants are transplants that are sited in an organ, and a heart transplant is a transplant that's sited in the heart, and the heart is a kind of organ. And I guess it should be fairly obvious from this that we should be able to deduce that heart transplant is a subclass of organ transplant. So how do we do that using this algorithm? Well, first of all, we transform this into the normal form. So these equivalences are basically just shorthand for two subsumption axioms. So we have the organ transplant implies transplant that's sited in an organ, and I can break that down. I can break the conjunction down at the same time and write that down as organ transplant is a transplant, and organ transplant is sited in an organ. And then I have to do the axiom the other way round. To reduce that to the normal form, I have to introduce a new concept that encodes this existential, because when I put that on the left-hand side, I'm not allowed to have the existential guy here if I'm going to be in the normal form. So I introduce this new concept, and then I say transplant and SO, cited in an organ, implies organ transplant. I do more or less the same thing for the second axiom, and I get this set, and then heart is an organ is already in the normal form, so that's fine. And then I start applying my saturation rules, so I can apply this rule, and I apply it to these three axioms in the ontology, and this says that heart transplant is cited in the heart. The heart is a kind of organ, and if you're cited in the organ, then you're an SO. Okay, and you can pretty easily see that from that, these guys fit in on the top here, and from that I can deduce that heart transplant is cited in an organ, which is pretty reasonable because we know it's cited in the heart and the heart is an organ. And then I can apply this deduction rule here to these guys plus the new axiom that I just derived, and what this says is that if I'm a transplant and I'm cited in an organ, then I'm an organ transplant. And if I combine that with the fact that heart transplant is a transplant and heart transplant is an SO, I've got both of the components on the left-hand side here, and I can derive that heart transplant is indeed an organ transplant. And so I've now derived this subsumption relation that I was looking for. Using this technique with these cyclic kinds of ontology that I was mentioning, you get really remarkable speed-ups because you avoid this business of constructing very large models. So this guy here, CB, is the reasoner that Yevgeny built based on this technique. And these are some other reasoners that are around. Cell is another reasoner that works for this polynomial fragment. But it isn't able to cope with the larger horn fragment, which these Galen ontologies use. And these three here are all tableau-based ontologies. And you can see that the speed-ups here are really quite impressive. And in fact, for this Galen medical terminology ontology, the new CB reasoner is the first time that any reasoner was able to classify that ontology at all. So every other reasoner we ever tried on that just goes off and never comes back. So the other fragment that's interesting that I wanted to also mention briefly is this AL2QL fragment. And this is, as I mentioned, targeted at applications where you have large amounts of data. And for this reason, the design of the fragment is such that it has data complexity for conjunctive query answering that's in a complexity class called AC0, which basically means that it's first order rewritable. And this is a slightly tighter bound than log space. But basically, if you want to be able to use relational database technology in order to answer your queries, you need to be in this first-order rewritability class. This is based on a family of description logics called the DL-Lite family. And as I was just mentioning, the whole raison d'etre behind this fragment is to be able to exploit query rewriting-based reasoning techniques. And these are also computationally optimal. the advantage with them is that the data storage and query evaluation can be delegated to a standard relational database system. And in fact, you can use ontologies to provide a sort of richer querying experience over data that's already in a relational database, over which you don't have any direct control, just a query interface. And some interesting work that that's been done recently by somebody else in my group at Oxford, Hector Perez-Urbina, is to show how you can extend this technique to languages beyond AC0, but then you have to delegate the query answering to more powerful engines, up to and including a data log engine for the most expressive fragment. So how does this technique work? Well, this technique, as I mentioned before, works by rewriting the query. And basically what it does is it expands the query to absorb, to reflect the information that's in the ontology. So the basic idea is that given an ontology and a query, you want to rewrite the query such that answering the rewritten query against the data with respect to an empty ontology would give you the same answer as answering the original query against the data with the ontology that you're using. So obviously when you come to use the database in the end, you want to have got rid of the ontology by that stage. And this technique that Hector developed, that's a very general technique for doing this, basically uses a resolution saturation technique, not dissimilar to the one used in the EL fragment. The idea is you clausify the ontology, you saturate that, you throw away redundant parts, and then what you have left is your query. I don't expect you to understand from that how it works, but hopefully a simple example will show you what I'm talking about. So let's say we have a little ontology here that just says doctors treat patients and consultants are a kind of doctor. And my query is I want all of those individuals, X, such that X treats some Y and Y is a patient. So it's fairly obvious that I should get both doctors and consultants in the answer to this query, and I want to rewrite my query to reflect this fact. So first of all, I clausify this, so I just turn it into standard clauses like this, where I use functional terms to represent these existentials. So if X is a doctor, then X treats F of X. And also, if X is a doctor, then F of X is a patient, and consultants are doctors. And then I start to run this saturation procedure. So basically, I unify this treats and this treats, and I produce a new clause here that says Dr. X and patient F of X, that should be in the answer to my query as well. Then I can unify the patients over here, and I can get this clause, and I then unify treats again, and I get this clause, and then I can unify doctor over here, and I get this clause, and then I'm done. I'm saturated, I don't have anything else to do, and I've generated this set of queries which now reflect the answer to my original query plus the incorporating the information that's in the ontology. I can now prune that set of queries because some of these queries have got function terms in which could never bind to anything in the database, so I can throw away those clauses that have got function terms in, and I'm left with these three guys. Basically, for this DL-Lite language, what I end up with is a union of conjunctive queries. So I've already mentioned that the idea is that data can either be stored in or just left in a database. I mean, one of the target applications here is where you already have a large data set and you just want to query that using the ontology. So you have to specify what the relationship is between the terms in the ontology and the database, and these are defined by mappings. So basically for each predicate that occurs, each vocabulary term that occurs in the ontology, you define how you would retrieve instances of that vocabulary term from the database using a mapping. So we might, in this instance, have a mapping that says, well, for doctors, what I have to do is I have to answer this query, which is select name from doctor. For patients, select name from patient. And for treats, I select doctor name and patient name from treats. Let's just say that I have this simple database structure. And then I can easily take this union of conjunctive queries that was produced by my rewriting, and I can translate that into an SQL query using these mappings. So the rewriting I just performed, I'd get select name from doctor, union, select doctor's name from treats, and patient, where the patient's name equals the name of the patient. And then I can just delegate that, answering that query to my relational database system, and the answer will just come back. So all of this sounds fine, lots of good stuff there. Of course, as ever with research, not all of the problems have been solved. There are still some outstanding challenges remaining. One of those is that, well, this saturation-based technique looks very promising. I think you could see from the results I showed you performance-wise that that this technique potentially is very effective, but unfortunately, at the moment, we only know how to apply it to these horn fragments. We'd like to find some way to apply it to fragments where we have to do some kind of non-deterministic expansion, and it isn't clear yet how we can do that. So that's work in progress. The query rewriting algorithm, obviously, in order to be able to do this rewriting into unions of conjunctive queries, you have to, well, there are several issues there. One, the fragment, this DL-lite fragment that has AC0 data complexity, that's a pretty small fragment. You really have to rein in the expressivity quite severely. And in some cases, it's just not possible to live within the expressive constraints that are imposed there. So we'd like to try to find ways of extending the expressive power. And as I mentioned, we already know how we can extend the same kind of technique to more expressive languages using a data log engine, but you know, then there are sort of issues of scalability with data log engines that need to be addressed. Also, even in the case where you are inside this DL-lite fragment and you can produce SQL queries, actually, one of the troubles is that if the ontology is quite large, the rewriting can get very large. So in fact, the rewriting can be exponential in the size of the ontology in the worst case. So you can get these very large queries that are of a kind that relational databases are just not well optimized to handle. It's not clear yet whether this is a kind of inherent problem or whether we just need some redesigned, different kind of relational database systems to be able to deal with these kinds of query better. And there's quite a lot of research going on in that area with different kinds of structures for databases. So this is also a work in progress. And finally, it seems pretty obvious that there should be some more discussion, integration between researchers working in database theory and description logics, because we're all doing lots of the things that are going on there are clearly incredibly closely related, but somehow going along their own ways independently. I mean, a couple of really obvious examples are in the database area, they very often use this technique called CHASE to, you know, demonstrate computational properties. And actually, if you look at what's going on there, CHASE is almost, identical to Tableau algorithms. So they're using a technique there that's very, very similar, but there are two complete communities there with their own sets of literature, and apparently as yet the two have not met. And another area is that, well, of course, the database research community have already recognized that there are some weaknesses in the basic model that they have there, and they'd like to be able to express things like the existence of data that they don't actually have in the database. So there is lots of work on dependencies there, things like tuple-generating dependencies and equality-generating dependencies. And again, it's clear that the kinds of thing they're trying to do there and the sorts of problems they have are incredibly similar and closely connected to what's going on in the description logic space with work on ontologies. But similarly, up to date anyway, these two communities have been going their own way, and there hasn't been too much kind of exchange of ideas there. And another thing that is very relevant here is open world versus closed world. So in the description logic space, it's a first order fragment, so it has this kind of first order open world semantics, which seems quite appropriate when you're dealing with schemas at the conceptual level, but it doesn't always seem very appropriate when you're dealing with data. So if you were to query a database, we were talking about this example before, if you query a train timetable database and ask the query, is there a train between Cambridge and Oxford departing, you know, after 10 and before 10:30, and the answer comes back empty. In this first order open world setting, that you don't know. The answer is, oh, well, I don't know if there's a train. You know, I have no proof there's a train. I don't know there's not a train. And obviously in a sort of data setting, quite often the closed world semantics is more intuitive and what's really intended. I mean, it's intended that this database of train times is complete. And if you don't find a train that answers your query, you should deduce the fact that no such train exists. But in the in the ontology setting, that's not that wouldn't be the case. So we have to find some way of integrating open world, which is appropriate in some cases, with closed world that's appropriate in other cases, and actually just even finding some coherent semantics for this kind of integrated setting is extremely challenging. It's not completely clear whether it's even possible to do that. So nothing remains other than to thank some of the people who contributed material to my talk, several of whom I think I mentioned during the course of the talk. And I also put together a select bibliography for people who want to find out more about some of these things that I only had time to skate over very lightly. And I'll leave this up on the screen while I answer any questions that you may have. So thank you for listening. Stunned you into silence. That's what I like to see.
All the way up there.
Just shout, I'm sure you can manage.
Well, it's recording.
Okay.
Hi, so lots of real world situations, you have uncertainty in your data or your model of the world, but lots of the stuff you talked about here was very sort of black and white in terms of the way you think about things. Presumably this addition of uncertainty further complicates all of the reasoning procedures. What's the sort of current thinking on that sort of stuff?
Yeah, you're right. It's an active area of research, particularly the There's quite an active group working on fuzzy extensions to these languages where you can assign certainties between 0 and 1 to some of the facts that you assert. It would clearly be useful. I mean, currently I'd say, and I think from a formal point of view, they know how to extend more or less all of the languages I was talking about. What's not so certain is computational feasibility, whether it's possible to build systems that could usefully support applications. The other thing that is tricky there is where you get all of these values from. It's hard work building an ontology and getting some group of people together and getting them all to agree, you know, that a heart is really a kind of an organ or whatever it is. You can imagine, you know, the conversations going on in the room here when you get a bunch of medics together and trying to agree about this. Imagine the additional difficulty if you had to get them, you know, to assign a probability between 0 and 1 of this being the case. I mean, in fact, nearly all of these medical ontologies, on the face of it, seem as though they're a good kind of case for the black and white, you know. I mean, of course, everything seems relatively black and white, but actually, you know, when you look into things in more detail, even in anatomy, most things are not completely certain. Apparently, it turns out that some very small proportion of people have their heart on the right side instead of the left side. So, you know, we could try to represent that. But it turns out to be useful in practice just to have this model of the typical case. And the compromise we make is that then we're able to provide these computational services that support applications.
Your example was very much geared towards vocabulary and sort of queries to large data sets. Can you give a few other more exotic examples where these ontologies are being used? In particular, one I would be curious about is the access control a useful area or an area that has been explored, where I often want to have a very compact representation of a very large matrix of who's allowed to do what, who's allowed to access which file, which service?
Yeah, I've seen applications where they've used ontologies in that setting. So, yeah, you have different kinds of users with different permissions, and you have some kind of ontology that describes this hierarchy of users. I mean, probably, although it seems like a big matrix of possible combinations, actually, when you come to write that down in an ontology, in any sort of realistic case, it's a fairly tiny ontology. So you could and also it's probably small enough that you can just write it down on a piece of paper, and there's nothing all that interesting to say about it. So it may be that that's the reason why you don't really see ontology reasoning systems used in these kinds of applications. I think some of them definitely do use a hierarchy that describes these different kinds of users, and you could use an ontology engineering environment to develop and maintain that hierarchy. I'm not sure whether anybody really goes to that trouble, or whether they just sit in the pub and write down, oh yeah, you know, administrator, user, we're done, aren't we?
Some of these can be rather big, and sometimes you have high-level policies that you want to be provably enforced by the larger thing.
Yeah, actually, this policy thing is another area where I have seen, and I'm not very expert on that myself, but I've seen papers written by, there's a guy called Bijan Parsia, who's at Manchester. And I think he's not doing much in that area now, but in a previous life, when he was at Maryland, they had a group there that were working on that, and there are some papers that you can find that talk about policy, specification of policies, and I've definitely seen papers on that. Whether it's really used actively, I'm not sure.
got a quick question. You were talking about the queries in terms of the A-box sort of queries. Do people do queries that are based on the T-box, in other words, sort of terminological queries?
Yeah, absolutely. I should have made that clearer. I mean, in some applications, that's really the raison d'etre. They have a model of the domain, a conceptual model of the domain, and they want to ask queries about the conceptual queries of the form. Is a heart transplant a kind of organ transplant, and they use ontologies quite extensively in some kind of biomedical applications where they want to kind of postulate theories and see whether or not that's at least consistent with respect to the knowledge they have about the domain. Or even compare results that they get from experiments and see if this data is consistent with the conceptual model that they have. And they actually have had some pretty good results with that. You know, they found out some interesting new information by either they discover that the model is wrong, so they get some data from an experiment and they compare that to the ontology and it's not consistent. And then when they look into that, they may discover that their knowledge of biology was actually faulty. What they thought they knew, they didn't really know. Or sometimes they discover that it's some, there's something interesting about the data. I seem to recall one case where they discovered some, they discovered some special feature of a pathogenic fungus that was unusual. It had some particular kind of protein in its makeup that other fungi didn't have. So according to their model, fungi shouldn't have that particular protein. And so that gives them a hint as to how they might look for some kind of treatment for this pathogenic fungus, something that attacks that protein, because generally fungi don't have that. So they've had some good results doing just this kind of thing. In fact, some ontology languages have gone kind of second order in the sense that they may sometimes want to assert facts about the classes. Having this kind of meta-ontology in a way, but I think it almost invariably turns out that at the very least the fragment of second order that you need can easily be embedded into first order using one of these kinds of technique where you just extend all of the arity of all of the predicates. So there's quite a lot of work in that area, actually, and it's some very controversial topic because some people claim that actually this is really an essential feature of any ontology language, that you should be able to have this kind of meta-ontology. And another framework that has been devised for writing down ontologies is a language called F-Logic, and it basically uses exactly this kind of syntactic second-order fragment that can be embedded into first-order for reasoning purposes just by using the trick of extending the arity of all your predicates. And, then the only predicate you really have in first-order is true. The actual predicate names get pulled into the first position of the extended of truth predicates. Well, you have a truth predicate for each arity. The difficulty with that, again, is really just this computational one. Even when you do that, you can get back into first order, but then you may be in some fragment of first order that's difficult to compute with, and the goal is to provide tools that will support users, and even the tools we have for these sort of nicely behaved fragments, it's very challenging to provide robust reasoning services for that. So, I don't have any inherent problem with it, it's just the practicality. It's also the case that you can get 90% of the way there just by allowing users to sort of in fact, this OWL2 language, one of the things it allows you to do is something that's called punning, which means that you can use predicates as individuals, but then there's no connection between the predicate name and the individual of the same name, if you see what I mean. So you could, if you have this kind of thing, the classic example is something like, some individual is an eagle, and then eagle is an instance of species. So then you're using eagle in one case as a predicate, and in the other case as an individual in this meta-predicate species. But you can get most of the way there just by allowing people to abuse the vocabulary and sort of breaking the connection between eagle, the species, and eagle, the type of thing. And OWL actually allows you to do that, but there are some cases where you would miss inferences that you would get if you really had this second order fragment.